remember. Let's go, Lord. Father, thank you for your enduring, eternal, not only existence, but righteousness. The judge of all the earth, he who knows everything and knows it all well and rightly. And Father, we are but humans, and we pray your blessing upon the life of our church and the life of our service, that we would see you clearly and that we would have your help in our ministry to you. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Luke 7, and we'll return to, I think it'll be fairly obvious toward the end why this text this morning. I'm dealing really with the subject more than the scriptures, which is kind of a complete reversal of part of the original purpose of Sunday school, but that's another lesson we'll get to in a few weeks. Luke 7, 1, when he had ended all his sayings in the audience of the people, he entered into Capernaum. And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear unto him, was sick and ready to die. And when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this, for he loveth our nation and hath built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them, and when he was now not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou shouldest enter under my roof. Wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee, but say in a word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers, and I say unto one, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned him about and said unto the people that followed him, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And they that were sent returning to the house find the servant whole that had been sick. And I was going to kind of leave that text there. We will return to the tension in that text towards the end. What I want to do this morning, right, we've been talking about religious influences in America, and we're kind of sort of at the late 19th century, the Second Great Awakening. And I just wanted to take our time this morning and deal very, very superficially, and I really do mean that, very, very superficially, and just talk about Baptists within that framework, within that period of time. Even within the religious world, we are rather odd ducks. I know that for some people in the world of Baptist fundamentalism, it's easy to develop the idea or the understanding that we are kind of the be-all and end-all and the catch-all of Christianity, and everybody should be like us. And there may be something in that. But the reality is that Baptists have been always a minority, often a very hated minority. and our history is a little bit of a challenge to follow. Because not even all Baptists agree on what the history of Baptists is. Most historians and many theologians would argue that Baptists as a denomination, like Baptist Church, go back to come out of England, although there were other Baptists prior to England, 16th, 17th century. But there really is a lot of discussion and controversy about the proper line of succession, and I'll touch a little bit on some of that controversy this morning. And in conjunction with that, part of the broader conversation is whether or not a Baptist is even actually a Protestant. And I'm sure that a number of you have been taught that although you are a Baptist and certainly not a Catholic, neither are you a Protestant. And so let me just kind of begin by kind of going over some of that argument, much of which I would not disagree with. I you know, I would we'll get to that. So, all right, part of the argument, of the explanation is that Baptists were not part of the group who broke from Rome. I mean, a pure Protestant, a true Protestant in the 16th century was somebody who had been a Roman Catholic who broke from Rome over the religious arguments of the day. And so part of our argument is, but we were never a part of that group of people. We were always outside of that group of people. So we never were a part of the Church of Rome. Now, what identity we had in all of that time is, again, another one of those great controversies. There's a little booklet called The Trail of Blood that tries to trace all of that, and that is not without its own dilemmas. Not only that, Baptists would point out that they have their own history of being persecuted by Protestants. Right? We know that there is tension between the Catholics and the Protestants. I read it this week in a book that I'm reading, and I thought that it was kind of appropriate because something that had a huge impact on Baptists in America was the issue of American slavery. And I've been reading a book on the Republic of the Congo. And when the Europeans, particularly the Portuguese, began to explore the Congo, they found that the Africans living in that part of the world were already practicing slavery, and that greatly facilitated their interest in the slave trade because people were already being enslaved. And the slave trade became so popular in the Congo that some priests who had gone over there to do missionary work actually left the priesthood, married local women, and then actually enslaved some of their own converts. And then the author points out, but they did retain this much of their religious practices, that they made a point in their wills of pointing out that their slaves could not go to a Protestant when they died. So you can give my slave to a Catholic, but not to a Protestant. So there's a great tension there. And the Baptists, to go back to our Sunday school subject, the Baptists like to point out that they were the victims of the Protestants as well. And of course, Martin Luther, for all of the contributions that he made to the Reformation and to an entire denomination that bears his name, he most vocally hated the Jews, and he had a particular hatred for the Anabaptists as well. So, thirdly, Baptists like to point out that they are not Protestants because they do not and never have practiced infant baptism. So that's never anything that we had to contend with. Fourthly, they point out that they're not Protestants because they do not hold to baptismal regeneration, which is the new birth by virtue of baptism. And all I would say to that is there are a large number of Protestants who baptize babies but don't hold to that either. So just have to be careful there. And then Baptists point out that they do not hold to reform or covenant theology, although some do. There are Reformed Baptist congregations. And so, as always, folks, you know, none of these things ever fit into neat, tidy packages like we would like them to. So even to talk about the history of the Baptists is to admit some cloudiness to exactly where we came from and how long we've been around and what distinguishes us from the others. One particular view of Baptists, and I'll probably get to this a little bit later on in another thing just on some Baptist divisions, but it rises out of two things, right? Number one, it rises out of the Second Great Awakening. And the Second Great Awakening, I'm going to use a word that we need to use cautiously, but it is a good word to describe it. The Second Great Awakening was very ecumenical in nature. Not Bible deniers and Bible believers in fellowship together, but Methodists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, even Baptists uniting together in revival meetings, working together, laboring together, supporting each other. It was very ecumenical. That was a big contributing factor to this. And the other is the question of what a Baptist is and where a Baptist came from. And so in the 1850s, specifically 1851, emerged this idea of landmark Baptist theology, to be a landmarker, coming from a text in Proverbs, "Remove not the ancient landmarks." It was particularly promoted by a man by the name of James Graves, James Pendleton, and Amos Dayton. And these men surveyed the landscape of all of this ecumenical activity, Methodists and Presbyterians and Baptists holding revival meetings, walking hand in hand, being in fellowship with each other. And they did not like what they saw. They did not like what they saw. And so the central tenet of landmark baptism is this very thing, the perpetuity of Baptists. That there have been Baptists since the apostolic era. That there have always been Baptists. And then, of course, because you can't find those people. Right? I mean, Paul never identified himself as a Baptist. And we can say, well, Paul taught Baptist theology, and I would not disagree with that. I would hope that I'm a Baptist because Paul taught Baptist theology. But that is not the same thing. And when you get into some of the groups that we talk about as being Baptist but not Baptist in name, we find that they have some of their own peculiar quirks, and they have their own historical situation that caused them to be what they were. It is true they were always outside of the mainstream church. It is true they tried to adhere to the scriptures. So to that extent, they were Baptistic, but a clear succession of people who were Baptist and only Baptist is very hard to find historically. Now, and I thought this was on the one hand somewhat humorous, and even more so very accurate. You know, I heard a man say one time that some lady criticized him for preaching against Catholics, and she said, "We never criticized Baptists." And he said, "That's because you were always too busy killing us to bother with criticizing us." And there is some truth to that. So, but, and again, if you recall some of what we talked about in the Second Great Awakening, right, we had a man like Charles G. Finney and his new measures, his new way of doing things, and Graves and his friends saw Baptists in embracing these ideals, and they began to argue against those ideals. And so again, they came up with this idea that a Baptist is a man who has Baptist perpetuity, Baptist heritage going back all the way to that. And you know, so one of the thing, a couple of things that have come out of landmarkism, several things are, number one, people who are strong in their landmark beliefs will only accept the baptism of somebody who is baptized by another Baptist. So that if you had gotten saved through a Bible church or a Berean church or a non-denominational church, had been baptized by immersion upon a public profession of faith, and then tried to unite with one of these churches, they would not accept that baptism because you had to have been baptized by someone who had the right Baptist heritage. And it also contributes, and again, these are issues that are, you know, I don't want to say complex, but not complicated, but a little more complex that I want to deal with this morning. But part of it was the idea of no universal church, which we could discuss forever. And another thing that came out of this is, again, the idea of close communion. And these ideas, I don't know that they're biblical, but you understand where they come because, right, part of our responsibility, folks, is to preserve the integrity of New Testament ministry. And right, I would hope that we would all agree that's what we ought to do. I don't know that we would always agree on what steps are necessary to do that. But New Testament people are supposed to be concerned with the purity of the New Testament church. And so these are part of the things that drive that. I will tackle that a little bit more at a later time. That date on that is 1851, and we're just going to not quite get up to 1851 this morning. So I talked a little bit in the beginning about what Baptists are or how they identify themselves. Never been Roman Catholic, not infant baptizers, certainly not baptismal regeneration, not covenant in our theology. Baptist, by the way, is actually a word that describes a particular form of church government. And it is a congregational pastor deacon model of church government. That's, if you just really want to pin it to the wall of what a Baptist is, that's what a Baptist is. We are not Anabaptists. Anabaptist is really not a denomination. It is a movement. What we share with Anabaptists is our commitment to baptism after a profession of faith. But we do not share generally in the idea of pacifism, which most Anabaptists did. And we do not share in the idea of communal living, which most Anabaptists did. Anabaptists were primarily people like the Hutterites and the Mennonites, people who lived in these, again, this is, right, one of the greatest ways, folks, to ensure the purity of the assembly is by all of us going out someplace and living on a plot of land together. And so anyway, I don't mean that in any way critically, because the driving factor, right? Nobody got up and said, you know what, I just want to be a weirdo. Right? I want to do something that will make the history books. They said, how do we practice our religion in a way that honors God and preserves the integrity of the New Testament people? And so, okay. For our purposes, right, we will just say the Baptists as a denomination. As a denomination. Not when people embraced Baptist doctrine but had other names, but when people embraced Baptist doctrine and said, we are Baptist. We are Baptist. We're gonna put that at about the early 17th century in England. In England. Two men, Thomas Helwys and John Smith, founded what are known as the General Baptists, and we'll come back to that, General Baptists and Particular Baptists. Helwys was born in England in 1575, participated in the illegal separatist English movements, died in an English prison in 1616 because of his religious principles. He was teaching against the established church, and he was imprisoned, and he died there. What was he? 30 years old, 31 years old when he died. John Smith was first an Anglican, grew up in the Anglican Church, which many English did, and then he became a moderate Puritan. And I find this interesting. What's a moderate Puritan? Well, a moderate Puritan was not opposed to using instrumental music in the worship service. So that made him kind of a moderate Puritan. But then in 1607, he broke with the Church of England, and so he becomes, these two men become instrumental in founding the General Baptists. They ended up falling out of fellowship. Helwys, and if you think about it, folks, right? I mean, this is kind of a dilemma, right? If the only church available to us was a church that baptized infants, and all of us had infant baptism, and then one of us came to the conclusion that infant baptism was wrong and baptism by immersion after a profession of faith is right, who would baptize you? Who would baptize you? And so Helwys baptized himself. And then he came under conviction that that was wrong. And so then he united for a while with the Mennonites so that they could baptize him. And then that caused him to have a falling out with John Smith, who said, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't have joined together with the Mennonites. So we're off to a great Baptist start. There are only two of us, and we're at war. right? But in 1609, living in exile in Amsterdam with other Englishmen, they formed the First Baptist Church by denomination. Here is a Baptist church. It spoke English. It was constituted almost exclusively of Englishmen living in exile, but they constituted a Baptist church. All right, so let's talk about what a general Baptist was, because this is going to be one of the major wings of the Baptist church. General Baptists, of course, believe in salvation by grace alone through faith alone. They believe in the baptism only of the saved. They believe in the separation of church and state. This is really, folks, a cardinal Baptist tenet. At least it is supposed to be, the separation of church and state. They believe that true worship is from the heart and that only the Bible is acceptable for use in worship. In other words, no books like the Book of Common Prayer, which the Anglicans used. They believed in the memorial view of the Lord's Supper. So they certainly didn't believe it was a saving ordinance. They did not believe that it conferred any grace. They believed in it was a memorial. They believed that church leadership was pastor and deacons. They believed that churches should be supported by the offerings of the membership, not by the tax dollars of the government. And as general Baptists, right, they believed in all the things that Baptists would believe in. As general Baptists, they believe in kind of an unlimited atonement, not a limited atonement. What they believed, and this is pretty common for Baptists, folks, it really is. What they believed is that Christ's death was for all people and effective only for those that believe. Now, I don't want to get into that fight. I really don't. But there are theological reasons for being a little nervous about that position. But it is a very common Baptist position. And I'm not trying to find fault with it. I really am not. But just to say, anytime, anything that we do, folks, and we try it and we go, this is what we believe, there's usually a reason for it, and there's usually somebody on the other side pointing out a reason to be concerned about it. So anyway, they believed in unlimited atonement in that Christ died to make salvation possible for all, but only those that believe. They were certainly not universalists. They believed in free grace, and here's how they understood free grace. That when God saved a person, God saved them freely. Okay. They believed, so under free grace, good works do not merit salvation. That's the Roman Catholic view. God saves you because you're trying to be good. Neither did they teach that good works maintain salvation. That's the Arminian view. That's the Arminian view. And I had two different conversations last week after talking about Charles Finney of people pointing out how contradictory his own testimony was about how God saved him with what he taught, right? He basically argued that it seemed to him that God himself appeared to him, and then he just turned it around into anybody could just do this anytime they wanted freely. And okay, so anyway, so they rejected the Roman Catholic view that your good works earn your salvation, that God will save you because you're attempting to be good, or that good works maintain your salvation, which is the Arminian view. That if you don't keep up the good works, God will take your salvation from you. But neither did they accept that your good works proved your salvation, which was the Calvinist view. They just believed that good works were something that God's people were supposed to do, that God gave his grace freely. That God gave his grace freely, that if you would believe on Jesus, God would save you. And that Christians ought to do good things, but that they didn't prove anything, because lost people can do good things. and they don't merit salvation, and they certainly don't maintain salvation, because most Baptists, well, general Baptists, did not really believe you could lose your salvation. And they also believed in free will. They also believed in free will. And that will become divisive in and of its own right. So when they said free will, right, when Helwys and Smith said free will, they just simply meant that man was free to choose salvation. That it was an offer that was made, and that there was no legitimate reason that a man could not accept that offer, and that is how they dealt with it. So there's kind of the beginning of the general Baptists, and they have their roots in England. They come to America in about 1685. A man by the name of Benjamin Laker is the first known man who identified himself as a general Baptist in America. He went to the Carolina colony, and Carolina didn't split into two colonies until 1712. So he just went to the colony of Carolina. The general Baptists were slandered when he went. Of course, Carolina was an Anglican colony, and so they were from the out. He was from the outset, you know, a religious outsider and a dissenter. And the general Baptists were slandered as free willers. And they said, you know what, we are free willers, and we will gladly embrace the name. And the first Free Will Baptist Church in America was founded in North Carolina in 1727 by Benjamin Laker's stepdaughter and her husband. They established the first church. And then there would later be another line of Free Will Baptists that would develop up in New Hampshire. But it will be a split off of the particular Baptists in that area. We will get to that. Some free will Baptists actually believe that you can lose your salvation. Others do not. So you just, you know, it's, again, one of those things, folks. We are complicated, complex creatures. And even in a church like ours, if we took the time probably to write out all the things we believe, we would find that there are many things we all believe and some things that we believe that are out of step with other things that everybody else believes. So, well, this is just the way people are. So, the Free Will Baptists, again, they have their own distinctions, and they will have their own divisions. And some will return to the predestination mold, and others will walk farther away from it. In 1814, in Philadelphia, the Baptists assembled in a general missionary convention and took steps towards creating a nationwide organization of Baptists. They wanted to turn the general Baptists into a national denomination. And their argument was that this would be an opportunity for them to gain respect and credibility. Right? If we are a nationwide organization, we will have legitimacy. One of America's most prominent Baptists by that time, a man from Virginia by the name of John Leland, was totally opposed to this. He just found the whole idea very offensive and likened what they were doing to the Israelites demanding a king like everybody else. Why would you want the respectability of the world? This is not, by the way, folks, a minor issue or minor question. We will see again in 1947 that it drives the new evangelical movement, the desire for respectability in the eyes of the world. Leland wrote, like people nowadays, they form societies, must have a president and two or three vice presidents to be like their neighbors around them. So, division, 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 division. So those are the general Baptists, the general Baptists. And then much later, all right, some of you have that heritage, right? Much later will come the regular Baptists under Dr. Hank Ketchum. That will be something different. So at this point in time in America, you have general Baptists, and then you have, secondly, particular Baptists. The particular Baptists and the Free Will Baptists as movements do not grow up together and then split. They originate as two completely separate movements, although both of them have their roots in England. Both of them come out of English Reformation argument, logic, and theological debate. They are sometimes known as hard-shell Baptists. They are sometimes known as primitive Baptists. I think probably most of them prefer to be called particular Baptists. Roger Williams was one of them. He established the First Baptist Church in Rhode Island in 1638. So we have general Baptists in the Carolinas, particular Baptists in New England. In 1851, one of America's great Baptists, a man by the name of Isaac Backus, became the pastor of a Baptist church in Middleborough, Massachusetts. He was a strong supporter of the American Revolution. He was a strong supporter later of the ratification of the Constitution. And he was a strong supporter of the separation of church and state. And among the many other things that Isaac Backus did, he wrote a 3-volume history of Baptists. So you can see how superficial I am to take 40 minutes and talk to you about Baptists. So in America, in the 1600s, there are two distinct threads or ideals of Baptists that are developing. There would one that would identify as such and be more inclined to be Arminian in its dimension, and there is one that would identify as such and tend to be more Calvinistic in its dimension. And each of them have a nationwide presence in America. These are American churches. The Baptists in the Carolinas had it harder than the Baptists in New England. They tended to endure more abuse at the hands of the Anglicans, and Baptists were still being imprisoned at the time of the American Revolution. And then, of course, each of them, because this is just what happens, folks. You know, we kind of laugh because most of us are Baptists, and some of you are lifelong Baptists, and Baptist family histories, and so that's what we know. And, you know, we tend to think that Baptists are the only people that fight and divide, but division is just something that is part and parcel of what people are and what they do. Sometimes these differences were very amicable, and sometimes they were very hostile. So, following the American Revolution, right, so we have these two major wings of Baptists that disagree on major theological points. But following the conclusion of the Revolution and the settlement of the West, Tennessee, Western Virginia, that part of the world, we see an explosion in the number of people who identify as Baptists. In fact, in the 30 years between 1783 and 1813, the Baptists saw about a 10-fold increase in their numbers. And of course, one of the things you know that Baptists do, they demand that individual churches have liberty, but they also very much are inclined to join associations of like-minded churches. And there are just, to this day, there are just multitudes of Baptist associations. So, by the mid-18th century, right, by the mid to late 1700s, moving into the 19th century, well, I guess really early 19th century, it is not the theology of Calvinism and Arminianism that is dividing Baptists. The big issue that is dividing Baptists is the issue of American slavery. And they are very much at odds over this issue. And the issue, of course, folks, and as you studied, the issue is on the one hand, relatively simple and straightforward, and on the other hand, very complex and very complicated when you factor in the legal dimensions that under which it existed and all of the things that are associated with it. John Leland, I've already mentioned him, who hated slavery, made this notation: as personal slavery exists chiefly in the southern states, so religious slavery abounds exclusively in three or four of the New England states. So he was taking a little bit of a broader approach to it. And part of the question became, could, right, the thing that really became the divisive issue that would ultimately be the trigger that would separate Baptists was this: could a Baptist missionary be a slave owner? Can a Baptist missionary be a slave owner? And what are the reasons, folks? I don't want to weigh into this, to the slavery debate, apart from pointing out to you that one of the weapons that was used by pro-slavery personages was a passage like Luke chapter 7. The word servant that you have there in your King James Bible is a translation of the Greek word doulos. It is the word bond servant. It is a way that Paul referred to himself. It was the word that used to describe somebody who owned somebody else. Not just a hired hand, but a person that was owned. Right? So here becomes part of the... Again, folks, right? Because what is going to happen is that we are going to argue this issue in light of the scriptures. Is it right for one person to own another human being against their will? Is it right for one person to own another person against their will? The Old Testament law made provision for you to sell yourself into servitude. So let's just take that off the table, right? Because people go back and they talk about that issue, but I would argue that is not at all the issue, right? A man who sells himself voluntarily into slavery, right? That's a man's voluntary choice. And he may argue that circumstances left him no choice, but he is selling himself voluntarily into slavery, and the law of Moses regulated what should happen in that instance. But the vast majority of slaves in the outside of Israel world, folks, were not voluntarily enslaved. They were the product of most often being on the losing side in battle. And so you became a slave. And at that point in time, you became somebody's property and you could be bought, sold, and treated pretty much as you willed. And most of the laws, even in America, permitted a slave owner to do whatever he wanted with his property. Now, right, so here's a passage in which a Gentile man has a very sick slave. And he appeals to Jesus. Actually, he appeals to the Jewish leadership. Will you go to your Messiah and will you ask him to heal my slave? And the Jews went and said to Jesus, will you heal this man's slave? Even though he's not a Jew, you should heal his slave. He's a good man. And Jesus said, I will heal his slave. And before Jesus could get there, of course, right, events turn and the man says, just say a word. And Jesus grabs the man and turns him around and does not say, what a despicable creature is this man who owns another human being. And Jesus does not say, here is an opportunity for me to weigh in on how I feel about slavery. Jesus says, I've not found a Jew with this kind of faith. I've not found a Jew with this kind of faith. So does that constitute Jesus' toleration of slavery? These are theologically charged debates, folks. And the Baptists begin to have them. And they began to have them at this level, right? We have formed an association of Baptists. We have endeavored to form an association of Baptists at a national level. But we don't all have the same mind on this issue of slavery. What shall we do? What shall we do? Let me give you the name of this book. It's called Baptists, Slavery, and the Road to Civil War. It is written by Obi Tyler Todd. This is what he says. In the years leading to 1861, the Baptist denomination often appeared like a kaleidoscopic reflection of the nation itself. As a result, the variety of Baptist views on slavery naturally mirrored those across the United States. Baptists debated everything from the proper interpretation of the Greek word doulos to the authority of texts such as Deuteronomy 20, 10 through 15. The road to civil war was not of two solid parallel lines, but of lines that sometimes blurred, crossed, and even overlapped before diverging with time and context. As sectional rivalries intensified and violent events like the Mexican War, Bleeding Kansas, and the raid on Harper's Ferry ignited the country into open conflict, Baptists inevitably chose sides like the rest of the nation. And they did. There was not a harmony. And this is, folks, the birth of America's most prominent, well-known Baptist denomination, the Southern Baptists. The Southern Baptist Convention was formed in 1845. And it was formed over the issue of slavery. This unifying body, this convention that came out of Philadelphia, this, by the way, was a common practice, right? What they did, right? We're divided about slavery. Okay. We're not going to talk about it. Nobody's allowed to talk about it. Nobody is allowed to talk about it in our convention meetings. The floor will entertain no discussion of slavery. It will entertain no motion about slavery. This was actually something, if I can go into American history for a moment, this was actually something that the United States Congress did. You know that part of your First Amendment rights was the right to petition your government. And the way that was practiced from the very beginning of the time until right on the border of the Civil War was this. You would write your representative and you would say, I wish the government would take up this issue, or I wish the government would do this, or I wish the government would stand here. Your representative, who represented only 30,000 Americans, by the way, that's another conversation, would take those requests to the Congress or to the Senate, to the House of Representatives of the Senate, and when Congress went into session, one of the first things they did was provide opportunity for all of the representatives to read these requests. The people of the state of Nebraska would like to petition the federal government to such and such. And over the course of time, so many of those requests came to be, we request the government to deal with the issue of slavery properly, that Congress just finally put an end to it, to reading the requests. So you could write your congressman, you could tell him what you wanted, but he was no longer allowed to go to the floor of the House of Representatives or the Senate and go, here's what the people in my district would like to have. Put an end to it, put a gag rule on it. All right, so this is what they did. We are a national convention of Baptists, and these are our policies. Nobody can talk about slavery. Don't bring any motion. We don't want to talk about it. It's not going to be up for debate. We're just not going to deal with it. Some Baptists from Georgia then, right? Because people are pretty crafty, and everybody knows that when you pass a law, the first thing that you do is figure out if there's any loopholes. And so a group of the local Georgia Baptist Association said, let's do this, right? We can't talk about slavery, but we're going to put a man forward and asked the missionary agents, or asked the society to support him as a missionary to the Cherokee Indians, and the man that we put forward is a slave owner. So we can't talk about slavery, but we can't talk about missionaries. And are we going to vote this man in as one of our missionaries in the full knowledge that he is a slave owner and he's going to minister to the Indians? The executive board of the National Association declined his application. We're not going to recommend him to be supported. And so the Southerners began to withhold funding, and in 1845 they formed their own convention, the Southern Baptist Convention, which was more tolerant, obviously, of slavery, and that's where the Southern Baptists came from. Now, you don't have to dig very deeply to know how much they have reversed their position and apologized for it, but that is where they came from. That is where they came from. And so everybody now has to make a choice, right? And most people stayed, and the Northern Baptist Convention will come. But by the time we get to the mid-19th century, right, the Baptists have their own theological lines drawn, and some get along and some don't. But the real divisive issue is the issue over the perpetuation of slavery. And that's where I'm going to stop this morning. And I'm over my time as always, and so I'm happy to talk with you privately or entertain any questions. But we will be back at 11 o'clock.